Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very much looking forward to talking with two authors today about their book titled The Sea and International Relations, just out from Manchester University Press. This is an edited volume, which takes seriously the idea that we should probably think about the sea, the ocean, in our work on international relations. I personally was quite surprised that we don't already. And yet, as soon as I read this book, I was like, oh yeah, actually, you're right. We don't generally think about it. And after reading this, I'm personally quite convinced that we probably should. So I'm pleased to have with us the two editors of the book, as well as obviously chapter contributors themselves. And so we have with us Dr. Benjamin de Carvalho and Dr. Halvard Lyra to speak about their book. Welcome the both of you to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Could we start off, please, with a bit of introductions from yourselves, including explaining why this book and why together? Halvard, could you maybe start us off?
Yes, my name is Halvard Lyra. I'm a research professor at NUPI, the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs, as you say, where I jokingly like to say that I do work on whatever people pay me to do work on. So the glib answer to your question is that we wrote this book because someone paid for us to write this book. Now, there's a longer and better explanation for that, but I'll leave that to Benjamin.
Yeah, so I'm Benjamin de Carvalho, also a research professor at NUPI. My interests have tended towards the more historical parts of international relations. Whatever there is to research, I tend to try to see the long history of it. I guess that's something Halvard and I have in common, which is probably why we've done this together. We've tended to find it more more fun, more interesting to work together on these projects. And why this book? Because it's part of a broader project, a project which we've shortened EMPRISE, which stands for Empires, Privateering, and the Sea. So the project started a long time ago with us thinking about privateering, largely because we thought privateering were cool. They were kind of like pirates, but no one had really, or no one, of course, someone had, but very few people, at least in IR, had looked at them. And it took us a few years before we understood how to treat them or how to make sense of them. And it was only in sort of seeing the importance of privateering for our conceptions of sea and land and the distinction between them and for the broader questions of states and empires that we finally managed to make sense of how we were to approach privateering and got funding for this rather large project on trying to tie the three together, empires, privateers, and the sea. And so the book is the first book in that project, and we're obviously quite happy with it, especially the cover, which you can't see when you hear us, but we're looking forward to a conversation.
Wonderful. Thank you both for introducing yourselves and how this goes together. It's always nice when you have two authors to kind of hear about it being a positive working experience together. So to get into the book a little bit, the book has three main themes. How did you choose them? What are they? introduce us to this. Benjamin, can you start us off?
Yes, absolutely. Of course, as you say, when someone tells you, well, IOR hasn't looked at the sea, then the answer is usually, well, they have. And to some extent, that's true. You see the sea treated in a few classics about geopolitics. There's, of course, a whole literature on maritime security. There's a literature on maritime governance. There's a lot of studies taking the maritime into account. But they, in general, I would say they're not trying to theorize the sea as part of the broader theoretical framework of international relations. And so what we did was we tried to see what had been done by international relations scholars and in related disciplines, such as especially geography. And on the basis of that, we tried to sort of tease out some broad themes, which we saw those treatments to have in common. The first being the idea of taming the sea, of mastering the sea. The idea there is that the sea is this this force that needs to be tamed in order for us to break free of the constraints it puts on where we are, so our ability to travel. The second is as we call it, traversing the sea, which deals with the sea as a space to be traveled upon with largely with goods, but also people, but basically transporting people from one place to another. And the final one is the idea of the space, the sea being a space that needs to be controlled or that can be controlled for the extraction of resources that be, it could be fishing, it could be oil, it could be any type of resource we find in the sea. So those are sort of three broad themes we think cover the ways in which the sea has been treated in more specialist literatures, and which we believe form a good basis for bringing the sea into the discipline in general.
Thank you for introducing them to us. Halvard, I'm wondering if we can turn to you to talk a bit about obviously the task of an edited volume, choosing which chapters to include. Can you explain that process a bit and maybe briefly introduce what they cover?
Yes, obviously. For us, it was important that we were not trying to enforce our interpretation of the sea on the field of IR or a set of authors. So what we did is we identified a number of themes we thought would be of interest. And then we had a general call for papers for a workshop, which we held in Krakow before the pandemic. We had a massive number of people showing up. I think we had 25 different papers presented. And of those 25, we sort of made a what we believe to be a representative sample. So this is sort of a bottom-up process in that, in a sense, this book serves as a sort of collected items of what IR scholars engage with when they're challenged to engage with the sea and thinking with the sea rather than just leaving the sea as something out there. So we chose these papers trying to, or chapters that is, trying to capture as much ground as possible, but also to have a diverse set of authors. We particularly wanted to highlight younger scholars, because we believe that a lot of the interesting things that have been written about oceans and the sea come from people who haven't been necessarily socialized into thinking about the sea as something which is just there to be traversed or manipulated. So we have an introduction, of course. Then we have three chapters which are tackling in different ways the sea as a theoretical space. That's Alex Kolas, Maria Malksa, and Benjamin and myself, in different ways thinking about the sea in material ways, the sea as a form of mythology, and in our case, the questions of gender and race. Then we have two chapters which are more specifically historical, by Mark Shirk and again by Benjamin and myself, dealing with the production of boundaries at seas and the challenging of order at sea. boundary drawing through the lines in the Atlantic, and privateering in Benjamin's and my case. Then we have four chapters dealing with more current topics, mobilities across the sea, navigational technologies, international law and the law of the sea convention, and fisheries by Andrea John Dixon, Jessica Simmons, Philippa Broru, and Kerry Guttlich, respectively. And then Xavier Guillaume and Julia Costa Lopez have written a wonderful concluding chapter on a different way of thinking, what they call terraqueous relations, thinking about the world and the sea together. So that's the chapters. And I think they give a fairly good sampling of what young and bright people, ourselves excluded from that, think of when you challenge them to think about the oceans and IR.
Thank you for introducing the chapters and explaining kind of the goal of it. I think it helps us, as you say, take a number of different perspectives rather than just read a book and get one idea. So I'd love to kind of go through some of these ideas. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be able to go into every chapter in the detail it probably deserves. But to start with probably one of the big questions that we've talked a little bit about already, Benjamin, could you tell us more about why international relations as a discipline has ignored the sea?
I can try. I think the most obvious one is that the sea today is a less experienced space than what it used to be. I think that we spend less time on the sea, and our experience when we're on it or if we're on it is not as close to the elements as it used to be. I think the changes in technology have simply led to the fact that the sea no longer figures as much as an obstacle as what it used to be, and therefore has tended to be assumed to just be there as something less of a space in which something happened, in which we sort of that was a transformative experience. I think it's sort of become simply a matter of how much time we spend on the sea. So in a sense, and I think we say the introduction, we think that space and time, or space has collapsed with time in our conception of the sea. We no longer think of it as a space in which something unplanned will happen. We just think of how many days it will take for a ship to go from one place to another. As a matter of fact, if a trip on the sea doesn't go as planned, it immediately creates a big story because it's sort of unexpected. I think there's a number of other reasons too. Probably that if you look at a map, the sea is assumed to be all the same everywhere. It's all blue. Well, on land, you have a number of different colors, yellows, pink, green, blue. It's obvious sort of to the eye that a lot of stuff is happening there between different states, which isn't happening with the sea. And so I think in a sense, the sea has become this sort of the space, this opposite space of land. And we're obviously quite landed creatures. We live on land. Fewer of us experience working with the sea. And I think this sort of correlates with what we've identified as sort of central dichotomies in international relations have been used to conceptualize the term from more traditional or medieval societies to the modern age, where we see the developments on land as being key to where we are today. And we also see our time as more that of a time of states as opposed to the empires that were built sort of overseas. So we tend to forget what happens overseas. We tend to forget the sea. And instead focus on what's closer to us in producing one conception of politics. So I think that to the extent that the sea hasn't been forgotten. It's figured there either as time or simply as a corollary of land. It's just assumed to have the same qualities.
Thank you for that. Halvard, is there anything you want to add?
Yes, I think two things. One of the things is, one of the reasons why IR has been able to forget the sea is that we've, the last two centuries, for better or worse, we've been living in a situation of naval hegemony. The sea hasn't really been contested. First Britain, then the US has ruled the waves. And we're used to the sea being a place where sort of goods just travel. And you can see the reaction when something stops working like it should. Like, for instance, when there was piracy outside of Somalia, led to a massive mobilization. And second, when the Ever Given sort of went on land in the Suez Canal and stopped the Suez Canal for a week, there was a massive uproar. People were so afraid that they couldn't get their iPads for Christmas during the pandemic. So this sort of brings into sort of perspective what happens when we can no longer rely on the sea as being this conveyor belt. And but I think in IR we've been used to thinking of the sea. It's just there. There's never any hassle with it, never any big hassle. So that's one thing. And the other thing not to forget is, of course, that international relations, if we disregard the geopolitical tradition and look mainly at the tradition of IR that was developed in North America after the Second World War, was largely built by scholars coming out of Central Europe, very concerned with Central European themes. And if you come out of Central Europe, there's a good reason why the oceans don't really figure in your theoretical frameworks. So those would be my add-ons to Benjamin's otherwise excellent comments.
Thank you for that. Halvard, could I stay with you for a moment? Now that we have this idea of why our IR has ignored the sea, you mentioned briefly earlier, and of course this is a key part of the book, the idea of rethinking international relations with the sea. Can you tell us what you mean by this?
Yes, that is sort of our way of squaring the circle, because in IR, as I think we can take as a good starting assumption, there's been only scattered work on the sea. On the other hand, there is a tradition in other disciplines of moving towards what people call a wet ontology or a blue politics, and really embracing the sea. Our ambition is somewhere in between. I think there's a risk of sort of going into the different, the other ditch if you're trying to sort of avoid the excessive focus on land and turning to an excessive focus on the sea. I think when we try to sort of have a terraqueous or amphibian project where we think IR with the sea, not as something separate from, but to understand in conjunction with. We kind of disregard landed politics when discussing the sea. As Benjamin said, we're landed creatures, we're bound to land. The water world of Kevin Costner's movie is a fantasy, and lucky, that's a lucky thing. But also when it comes to sort of thinking with the sea, it's we're trying to capture sort of what Lévi-Strauss in his back in the day thought of things that are good to think with. And I think oceans are good to think with, because even though they're not, we don't really discuss oceans in IR, you'll see the references to the flows and the streams and the waves. Those are sort of permeate analysis. There is something about moving water and the oceans which attracts metaphor and ways of thinking. So we're not really, we're trying this in this book not to fall in the metaphor trap all the time, but it's easy because oceans are good to think with.
Well, let's stay on that idea of thinking, metaphor perhaps, and theory. Benjamin, how does studying the sea through the lens of IR give us a better conception of political space, both in terms of the sea and also in general?
I think Halvard touched upon some of this when he talked about terraqueous relations, about the idea of thinking of sea and land and their interplay. I think the obvious answer to that is that thinking about the sea as a space gives us a whole conception of the globe, rather than sort of seeing different slices of it. And I think that for obvious reasons, the sea is becoming, or the politics of the sea are becoming more important today than they have before. We're feeling the sea, or a number of states are feeling the sea rise as a consequence of our politics, or lack thereof, at least as a result of our activity on land. The question of pollution of the sea is coming to the fore to an extent that it hasn't before. So I think that thinking of sea and land together gives us a better idea of how different aspects of space interplay with each other, the extent to which land affects the sea and sea affects land. I think especially today, if we're looking at the challenges we're facing as especially in terms of climate, we need to think about that interplay and understand politics of space as something radically different than what our tradition of thinking has done before. As Alred was saying, you know, our tools are largely from an era when the sea wasn't as or perceived as important to the politics of land. So obviously, in terms of climate, I think there's thinking of sea and land gives us a better way of conceptualizing the challenges we face. If we look at developments, sort of more geopolitical developments, we also see that the distinction between land and sea, while being, I think, maintained in our ways of thinking, nevertheless tends to kind of merge if we look at the activities of a number of states around the globe. China, for instance, is building artificial islands as a way of controlling the sea, so they're creating land in order to control the sea. And I think that this type of sort of spatial politics is something we can't really conceptualize unless we think of sea and land as more of a continuum within which a type of politics happens.
I think that idea of kind of continuum and new things coming up is really helpful. And I think it's worth bringing together sort of two things that you both have mentioned so far, this idea that tools might have come from a less sea-oriented tradition and group of people, but also the idea of unchallenged or uncontested seas, that there has been such a domination by the British and then the Americans of the oceans. And that has, in fact, created a conception of the sea. You spoke about it a little bit at the beginning, kind of a thing that we can travel over, and maybe sometimes there's pirates to make it more interesting. But we do have quite a strong traditional Western Anglo-American representation of the sea. Halvard, can you tell us a bit about kind of how that influences IR and why we need to challenge this inherited belief?
Yes. The thing is, it's always difficult to try to see yourself from the outside, right? I mean, we have grown up in the West and deeply influenced by this. I mean, if you read the Hornblower novels, or if you read Master and Commander, or Pirates of the Caribbean, whatever, the sea is presented in that one specific way. But what we've tried to do is to look at this from the outside, and we try to do this by emphasizing how the sea has been constructed in a Western tradition in terms of gender and race. And if you look at the oceans, they're typically both in sort of metaphor and in theology and in literature are typically given what we would call feminine traits. They're associated with being unsteady, dangerous, typically over last centuries also dark. So there is a sense in which the sea is opposed to land. Land is rational. Land is associated with all things masculine. Oceans typically with things associated with femininity. Land associated also with things associated with, in classical racial thinking, with white, sea with colored. So this leads to a sort of further corollary, namely that the sea is a place where the white man goes to do things, The white man goes out to conquer. The white man is the one who has the ability to navigate the oceans. This is ability that is sort of not available to anyone else. Now, this is a fairly strong trope in the Western tradition, perhaps most explicit in the Anglo-American tradition, because, again, Britain and America has ruled the waves. There are some different ways of thinking about it. Of course, you find in any dominant representation, you'll also always find undercurrents. I mean, if you go to a classic like Moby Dick, the ocean is sometimes gendered male, sometimes female. Also, there is a respect in many of the engagements with the sea, which sort of constructs the sea as a worthy opponent. So there are ways of mixing up this, but I think there's a dominant narrative of oceans being dangerous, oceans being treacherous, oceans being a place where manly men go to do their thing. Now, I think, why do we need to challenge this? First thing we need to challenge is because it's really, really bad history and anthropology and what have you not. I mean, women have been at sea in droves. You just have to think for 20 seconds about all the women being shipped across the oceans as slaves, and you'll see that women have been at sea and people of color have been at sea. And we know that outside of the European sort of experience, different people have gone to sea. Just think about sort of how Polynesia was populated and how the sort of Easter Island was populated. Of quite clearly, other people have gone to sea, and other cultures than the Western have had different ways of thinking about the sea and who gets to interact with the sea. And so this is bad history, bad anthropology, but I also think it has created or helped create this notion of the sea as a space to conquer and something from where we can extract value. Now, this is, of course, not exclusive Western or male ways of thinking about the world, but I think it's useful to upset them because in the world where we're living, the challenges which is we're facing when it comes to climate, when it comes to overfishing, when it comes to sort of conflicts over oceans, I think we need to at least upset and challenge some of these dominant representations of the sea to see if we can find better ways of engaging with the oceans.
Hmm. Benjamin, is there anything you'd like to add about thinking about race and gender when bringing the sea into IR?
I think the important thing here is questioning the ways in which dominant ways of thinking help maintain hegemonic structures. And I think that both gender and race give us a lens through which we can critically assess the extent to which our way of thinking about something as mundane as the sea actually works towards a type of power politics or maintain a specific type of domination. Now, why we're thinking about that in a chapter, I think it was always part of the project that we would think about gender and the sea. To some extent, it's because it's become part of a habitus of any project to question these aspects when conceiving of the project. But as we started working with a book, it seemed to us that these conceptions were especially important to question when it came to the sea, because as Halvard touched upon, I mean, they're so important in creating a certain conception of the subject matter of the sea that they need to be called out. And I think, you know, especially because the sea, as I mentioned initially, the sea is not a lived space. So it exists in our minds through the stories we tell, and especially about the way we talk about the sea, and that way, as we try to make clear in our chapter, is not benign. It puts a number of things to the fore, and the silences a number of other things. One example I could mention is, for instance, the number of women who are at sea. If you look at the official statistics, most of the statistics are quite old on this, but basically they will tell you that there isn't a single woman on the sea. But if you look at what forms the basis of those statistics, they fully ignore a large part of the maritime industry, which is the cruise industry and ferries. Now, if you take that into account, of course, there's not a majority of women at sea, but still, the number is not as the statistics would have us believe initially. There are a lot more women at sea than we think. And as Halvard was saying too, the sea is much less of a space for masculinity than what is very often assumed. And I think it's important to try to expose the way in which our discourses about this actually contributes to larger processes of power.
Thank you both for your thoughtful responses on that and the work you're doing to ensure that we do think about conceptions that may have been handed down and hopefully try and expand and improve them. Not related necessarily too much, but kind of, this idea of expanding things that maybe we don't think a lot about. Halvard, I was wondering if you can tell us a bit more about privateering and how that particular example can help us when we try and bring the sea into international relations.
I'd love to. Privateering is, of course, what started us on this oceanic adventure in the first place. I think privateering help us bring together the sea and international relations in a number of ways, and I'll start by pointing out two of them. Two central concerns in international relations. One traditional concern has been state building, and over the last decades also empire building. And what privateering allows us to see is how what we refer to as the other states went to sea. Because when Europe starts expanding in the 15th, 16th centuries, Portugal and Spain go out and they get the papal acknowledgement of their right to split the world in two, basically, saying that Spain takes one half, Portugal takes the other. No one else is allowed to go really outside of European waters. So the French and the English and after a while the Dutch don't like this. They want part of the spoils. So they send out privateers, which have the added benefit of giving you plausible deniability. You send out a privateer and someone complains about his actions, and you can say, well, actually, I didn't mean him to do that, and he wasn't sort of, that wasn't the plan, and he never got a letter saying he could do exactly that. It's not me, he did it on his own. Well, still, when he returns to Britain or France or whatever, you ennoble him and you share in the spoils. So privateering is part of what breaks the sea open, which allows for England and France and the Dutch to actually engage with the rest of the world rather than sitting at home and waiting for Spain and Portugal to take home the goods. And the money that comes in from this is crucial when it comes to state building in Northern Europe. It's also crucial when it comes to empire building. Take, for instance, the Dutch East India Company, which in its heyday was probably the largest company in the world. The initial funds that sort of drove that in its first couple of decades came from privateering in the Indian Ocean, directed primarily against the Portuguese. Likewise, the French and British, part of the fortunes that sort of sparked their colonial ventures into the Caribbean and North America was built on money coming in from privateering. So privateering helps building stronger states in Northern Europe and also enables empire building in the colonies. Now fast forward a while and empires become, privateers become also a tool in the destruction of empires because when the American colonies decide to rebel, they don't have a navy, but they need to engage with the British on sea, so they raise privateers. Privateers are crucial in making it possible for French troops to get to America and to sort of eventually win the war for the United States. And then some decades later, the Spanish colonies have learned a lesson when they try to break free from Spain. They recruit English, French, and other privateers to fight for them. So what we're seeing really is privateers are tying together state building, the creation of new states, the building of empires, the destruction of empires. So they're really key to the understanding of the building blocks of international relations. They're also key in really showing us how international relations became systemic, and that these states and empires started bumping into one another across the globe, and often in the form of privateers. So we think that really privateering helps us understand and tie together the sea and international relations in ways in which really no other single practice can do.
Benjamin, is there anything you'd like to add?
Oh, absolutely. Once you get us started on the question of privateering, there's no stopping us. I think that in the interest of our listeners here, it's important to maybe make clear what we think by privateering, because obviously it's an activity that took place in a number of regions, and privateers came from a number of states, and they were called a number of things. They were called corsairs, corsarios, just as I think actors engaging in maritime predation have taken a number of guises and have been given a number of names too. I mean, some were called buccaneers, etc., etc. What we mean by privateering, of course, privateering is rather anachronistic, because it's an analytic term we impose on our subject matter from the 1500s and onwards, while the term itself came only in circulation sort of late 1600s. Essentially, we mean maritime predation under sovereign license. So there were ships that were able to engage in plunder at sea, sanctioned by a sovereign. This is quite different from piracy, which involved plunder tout court. Now, to some people, this doesn't matter, because in practice, sometimes the distinction wasn't as clear-cut as what we wanted to be analytically. Yet, I think to the people who were facing either privateers or pirates, it mattered a great deal, because essentially, if you were attacked by a privateering vessel, you probably wouldn't lose your life, whereas you were guaranteed to if you met pirates. It's also important because it places privateering entirely different in a different space when it comes to how European states interacted with the rest of the world. As Halvard said, it ties it to empire building, because a number of states were not allowed to go to sea initially. As you'll remember, the Treaty of Tordesillas divided up the known seas between the two Iberian powers, Spain and Portugal, and Northern Europe was not allowed to engage in that activity. And so, as Albert mentioned, the issue of plausible deniability was key. But it was, I think, that just as we can say that for the Vikings, the type of ship was crucial for the sort of Viking plundering activity, and the privateer, the concept of what a privateer was crucial to the states engaging in activities through these agents, because it allowed them to plunder other ships, to pose a threat to the Iberian powers, but it also allowed them to trade with the colonies, something they weren't allowed to. It also allowed them to trade between the different colonies, and often not even their own colonies, but for instance, those of the Spanish. So the privateer would go there and try to attack Spanish shipping, but they would also try to sell the goods they captured and enter into all kinds of interactions with different parts of different empires. In that sense, the idea of privateering breaks down what we often see as a dichotomy between war and trade, or plunder and trade. And I think it's important because it also breaks down a number of other dichotomies. I think that I mentioned two earlier, the dichotomy between sea and land. Of course, they were ships, but they engaged as much in activity with on land as they did at sea. They were agents of states, but they also built empires. In that sense, they break down the dichotomy between state and empire. they also break down this idea that we have that the distinction between public and private was crucial in the making of modernity. These were not sort of fully private actors. They were, as I mentioned, operating under sovereign license and often funded by public authorities as well. And so all these, we have this idea that the modern world emerged as we sort of, as a result of moving away from one thing to another and creating these clear-cut dichotomies between us and our past. And looking at change through the institution of privateering questions those dichotomies and makes the move less of a clear-cut move than the process of gradual and often not unilinear change. So in that sense, I think privateering is especially important. It also accounts for one of the sort of more important shifts we've ever seen globally. I mean, I mentioned the Iberian powers allowed to deal with the sea by the Treaty of Tordesillas. If you look at the world two or three centuries after Tordesillas, the Spanish and the Portuguese empires are no longer the empires that that they were. Instead, we have France, England, and the Netherlands dominating the globe in different ways. And, well, I think we need to stay clear of sort of single explanations here. In our mind, at least, it's clear that the institution of privateering played a big part in explaining that power shift. So we're not claiming that we have a new explanation supplanting Max Weber's Protestant ethic here to explain the move from Southern Europe to Northern Europe. But still, it's another process that sort of tries to tackle that long change that happened over time.
Well, clearly the two of you remain very excited about investigating and explaining privateering. And one of the things that I particularly appreciated about the book, and you've mentioned it earlier on, is the idea that this is not meant to be the only book that ever talks about the sea in international relations or the only way to think about it. And in a lot of ways kind of opens us up for more work and more conversations. So perhaps not so much about the two of your work, because I'm going to ask about that separately. But with this book kind of out there, with the people involved with interesting ideas and hopefully more once more people read the book, I was wondering if either of you, maybe Benjamin, you could start us off, could tell us about some of the areas you're most excited about seeing further explored kind of now that we're having this conversation.
Absolutely. I think that what we try to do with this book is really opening up a conversation about the sea. And we're really hoping that a number of people will read it, engage with it, criticize us, come up with new ideas. I think one of the ways in which we hope to see some changes is obviously in trying to incorporate the sea more into our thinking about international relations in general. And we touch a bit upon it in the book. We also sort of clearly emphasize that this is an important aspect which we would like to see more of happening in the future. I think that what we need to do is try to increasingly bring together people from different disciplines who think about the sea and help them think with international relations about how land and sea together are important for tackling the challenges which we face today. Another thing which I hope we'll see more of is attempt at conceptualizing the sea without the vocabulary which we've developed to deal with land. I'll give you one example, for instance. I mentioned these artificial islands that China is building now. One way people have described this is as if China is territorializing the sea. We see they're using the concept of territory, which is terra and orium, meaning the land that belongs to someone. Traditionally, it's understood as produced by sovereignty. So states are being sovereign. They produce, they turn land into territory. That's sort of the understanding we'll get from geographers, but applying that to the sea, I think is problematic. So territorializing the sea in a sense, I wouldn't say that it's a contradiction, but it's certainly using concepts which don't fully account for the what we're seeing in practice. And so I've seen a few authors using the correlated concept of aquatory, so taking water and the Latin aureum, so territory versus aquatory, as a way of developing new concepts that can better grasp the activity going on, but also help us in distinguishing between these two spaces, so that the sea doesn't stay this forgotten space, but instead sort of becomes alive with different concepts that interact with ways we're used to thinking about. We're working on a related project now, which is run out of Copenhagen and led by Christian Buger, who's been doing a number of engagements with the sea. About ocean infrastructures. So the idea there is to sort of look at how ports, but also we're writing about how treaties and law in general maybe creates a type of infrastructure upon which we build our understandings of the world. And so looking at ways in which I think these sort of large structures produced by our way of thinking about the sea generate our understanding of the global, I think is one way in which I think, or an area in which I think there's a lot to find out.
Halvard, is there anything you'd like to add about things you're excited to see others do, or things that either or both of you are working on next?
Yes, to start with, what I think would be interesting to see is I mean, again, we were only sort of making a first, well, I shouldn't say dig at this, because we should have a metaphor from the sea. We were just taking the sort of the first leap into the water, to say, put it like that. I think there is still work to be done when it comes to theorizing the sea, and theorize the sea with land. I think there's a tendency to think, we have examples of different ways of theorizing the sea in our book, but I think there's a need for synthesizing some of the materialist and the ideationalist analysis to see if they can work together rather than on parallel tracks. That would be of great interest, I think, and it might be what opens up for better thinking about the sea in international relations and international relations with the sea. For the stuff that we've been working on, I think our chapter on gender and race is quite explicitly only a first step. We're trying to bring some of the literature from other disciplines in closer contact with IR. We're not pretending to do a sort of fully feminist or post-colonial study of the sea. We're just trying to show that there's a lot of stuff to be done. I hope that others in IR continue to do this, because there's a lot of interesting work in geography and anthropology, but not necessarily tackling the kinds of questions that IR tend to ask, sort of bigger macro questions. When it comes to the historical work, I would love to see some of the work being done in international history about the international slave trade and the oceanic slave trade brought into contact with IR. I think it's almost absurd that we don't have a great big project on IR and slavery. We have excellent people working on slavery in the world, also coming out of IR, but for some reason it hasn't been a big topic, or as big as it should be in historical international relations. Finally, I think there's we hope that the current affairs chapters in our book open up for ways in which people can come out of their silos when thinking about topics. I mean, we want these, when people deal with topics of the sea in IR, they typically do it in these small silos where they're thinking about the Arctic or some other region, or it's fisheries or some very specific either sort of area studies topic or one specific form of resource kind of topic or negotiations. I would love to see these current affairs being brought more broadly into the overall IR conversations, be they on security policy, on global economics, on global ethics, or what have you. So that's where I sort of hope people will, I hope our work can be to some inspiration. We couldn't possibly follow all these trajectories ourselves, but we are working on what Benjamin referred to with a group in Copenhagen on infrastructures and the sea. We're also, as part of the M-Prize project, in the process of writing a book about privateers, which shows you why we have so much to say about privateers and why you can invite us back in 2 years' time to have a long conversation about all the bases we didn't cover today about privateers. And a little further down the line, there will be a book on empires as the third part of the trilogy coming out of the Empire Project. We're also working on other more or less related projects, but those are the ones that have closest to the top of the agenda from my point of view.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both for sharing the many different strands. I think this book very much is opening and inviting people into a conversation. So I hope to see many, if not all of those strands picked up by who knows who, and have many conversations going forward. And Halvard, you're exactly right. When the both of you have the privateering book published, we will have you back and you'll tell us even more about privateers. But in the meantime, of course, the book that we've mainly been talking about is called, quite straightforwardly, The Sea in International Relations. It's just out from Manchester University Press. So if any listeners want to go check it out, you can join the conversation and thinking about the sea in international relations there. Halvard and Benjamin, thank you so much for sharing your time, insights, and expertise with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.